It's the Burt Cohen Show. Either way, it was going to be a dream for one side and perhaps a nightmare for the other. The election of 2012 is now behind us. And my goodness, what an election it was. The dollars that were spent, unbelievable, unfathomable. And boy, there were some real surprises here. I am very surprised at some of the outcome. We're going to talk about what it means for the Republican Party as we move forward, as we move beyond the election. A lot of questions were raised. I'm very pleased to have with us Fergus Cullen, who was chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party from 2007 to 2008. Fergus Cullen, thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Well, thank you, Senator.
Well, I have to say, if you had told me, just a few days ago even, that the New Hampshire State House, the House of Representatives, the 400-member body would go majority Democrat. I never, ever dreamed that would be possible. My question is, was Bill O'Brien the best organizer for the Democrats? Bill O'Brien, for those who may not know, was the rather controversial Speaker of the House, often called Bully O'Brien. What do you think, Fergus? Was he the best organizer the Democrats ever had?
Well, you know, look, if you're looking for a scapegoat for what just happened on the Republican side, don't look at Mitt Romney, don't look at Ovid Lamontagne, look at Bill O'Brien and his inability to control the highly ideological, oftentimes borderline crazy members of his House caucus the past 2 years. I underestimated the extent to which the Democrats were able to make that an issue.
Yeah.
But look, it wasn't just them making it an issue, Senator. It was their own actions, which hung them. And, I heard from one voter, he said, I voted for Hassan because I couldn't vote against O'Brien because, you know, he wasn't in Bill O'Brien's state rep district. I think that it primed regular swing voters to believe the worst about Ovid Lamontagne because they'd seen some pretty ugly stuff going on in the legislature.
Yeah, it's true. And the ads between Maggie Hassan and Ovid Lamontagne, there were some attack ads on both sides, and the Hassan ads, at least some of them, did focus on Ovid's support for Bill O'Brien, basically saying, correct me if your memory is more accurate than mine, basically saying, if you like Bill O'Brien, hey, go vote for Ovid Lamontagne. It's amazing how the public was aware of who the Speaker of the House was. A few months ago, Andy Smith, who is a pretty good pollster for UNH and WMUR, asked people in a poll, just an open question, what other issues do you care about? And he was amazed at how often people said Bill O'Brien, the Speaker of the House, who was clearly dictatorial, who didn't recognize the legitimacy of the executive branch or the judiciary branch. He really thought it was it. So perhaps tagging Ovid Lamontagne with Bill O'Brien was effective. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it was. Again, not because Ovid was part and parcel of all the stuff that had gone on in the legislature, but because, again, it just voters were inclined to believe the worst because they'd seen it. I mean, I personally think that it would have taken somebody like Ovid to be able to stand up to some of the more extreme elements within the party and say, look, we're not going to go there on that particular issue, or we're going to focus on jobs and the economy because that's what people really care about.
Yeah.
But I think that, this legislature, I do think, Senator, and you and I may disagree on this, I think they had a very good record when it came to taxes and spending and rolling back what I would see as the excessive spending in the Democratic majority and under Governor Lynch. But that positive message was never heard because it was completely obscured and overshadowed by things like rushing to make concealed carry legal within the state house, charges of having bullied an elderly woman state rep to the point of tears. All this stuff is what regular voters heard, and they concluded the inmates are running the asylum.
Yeah, well, I wonder what happens now with the Republican Party. I mean, Bill O'Brien was reelected, and he said he's not going to run for any leadership position. And a couple of people, the Quants, father and son from Exeter, fairly moderate Republicans, they lost too. They got swept out. So and the Democrats now have at least 217 in the House. It's amazing. Do you think that you mentioned carry policy in the state house? I mean, I know parents whose fourth graders often go to the state house. It's pretty much part of the curriculum. But they were nervous about sending their fourth grade kids to our seat of government because there's a lot of people with guns walking around. What about those gun issues, and more specifically, the social issues, the issues like reproductive rights for women? Before you answer, I got to say, as somebody who was definitely pro-choice, my sense is, I mean, politically, it has never moved people to get up out of their homes and go into their voting booths. The reproductive rights question, in terms of those who favor women's choice, it just hasn't moved women. I think it may have this year. What do you think? And will the New Hampshire Republican Party, I'm not sure what you'd like to see. Do you think they realistically will drop the social issues like gay marriage and abortion rights?
Well, I write an editorial page column for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and my piece, which will be in tomorrow's paper, addresses this specific issue head on. Uh-huh. And look, what I'm arguing is that occasionally a party has to make a strategic retreat on an issue and acknowledge that they fought the good fight and that they lost. So, the New Hampshire Democratic Party has basically changed tactics when it comes to a broad-based sales or income tax, and now most of them recognize that in order to get elected, they need to take the pledge. Regardless of their personal beliefs, that's their position, and that's how, when they've governed that way, as John Lynch did, they've been politically successful. Conservatives had to do this in the 1950s when they had to confront the issue of the New Deal. We'd fought it for 20 years, and eventually they had to say, we're going to accept this and move on. Similarly, Southern conservatives, typically Democrats then, now Republicans, came to similar terms with a peace with the civil rights movement. They had resisted it for many years, they accepted it, and they moved on. I think it's time for New Hampshire Republicans to do this on social issues, to say, look, on when it comes to gay marriage and abortion policy, we're going to accept existing law. We are not going to go and refight these battles every 2 years, and we're going to concentrate on other issues. And then, walk the walk, say, no, we're just, regardless of my political beliefs, my personal beliefs, and my political position is we're going to accept existing law on this. Because it has been an issue that the Democrats have used effectively to drive a wedge between women voters and Republican candidates. The gender gap in the governor's race this year, Maggie Hassan carried men by 1 point. She carried women by 22. She carried women 60-38. And, if Republicans are going to win, they need to be getting those votes back. And these issues are, again, putting up a barrier between women voters and Republican candidates that they can't overcome.
Well, you do raise some interesting points. It's great to have your perspective, Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, who's still quite active. I'm not in the state Senate anymore, but I like to think of myself as active, too, because we care. We are citizens. I'm sure, Fergus, you share the same frustration that I do with, when we were out there on the streets calling for people to vote our way, we'd occasionally run into people who said, I don't vote. I get frustrated with that. I suspect you agree. I'd rather have people vote the other way than not vote at all. I mean, it's just so important. We must certainly agree on that. Well, what happens now with the Republican Party? It's big in New Hampshire. It has been, 300 or so members in the House. And there's a lot of Republicans. This has been traditionally, the Union Leader has been strong, is a strong Republican population here. And the new people that came in 2010, there was frustration with the Democrats, a lot of, I think, confusion about Obamacare. That was probably the best organizer Republicans ever had in 2010. But the free staters came in, the hard right that we talked about with regard to the social issues, who just wanted to impose their beliefs on everybody else. You're advocating that, come on, let's just move away from that. What happens to the hard right? Do you think, are they going to recognize that, just from a strategic point of view, it's the right thing to do? Or do you think, is there any chance there could be like a third party or like, a real split and perhaps a mini civil war in the Republican Party in New Hampshire as well as in the nation as a whole?
Well, you mentioned the Quants from Exeter, who are basically moderate Republicans, pro-labor Republicans. They're a little out of step with the party. The idea that they were going to be an effective challenger to Bill O'Brien within a Republican caucus, I think, was ludicrous.
It wasn't going to happen.
But you mentioned that they got swept out in the tide the other day, and that's the thing with these tides, Bert. We've seen them benefiting Democrats and hurting Democrats, benefiting Republicans, hurting Democrats, Republicans in the last couple of years. It's not as though it's Passover and there's blood on the door and the angel skips over the houses of the good guys and just takes out the nuts. So in this case, this last election in Rochester, the entire Republican caucus there was effectively members of the 912 Glenn Beck group.
Oh my.
Frankly, quite extreme, well out of the mainstream. They all lost except for one.
Oh.
And yet moderates like the Quants also lose. So when you damage the brand, everyone suffers. Grover Norquist, a great antagonist of the left, talks about it as the mouse head in the Coke can. That if there's a scandal with packaging and some consumer finds a mouse in her Coke, that, it hurts all soda. Why does McDonald's and Burger King not attack each other on the quality of their meat in their competitor like we would in politics? It's because it damages all hamburgers, so they get suspicious of everybody. So that's why you don't see that kind of attack happen in consumer goods that you do in politics. So, in this election, basically all the nut job Republicans got swept out of office, and some of the good people, the folks who care about civility, the folks who care about tone, people who had been there for a long time and understood that sometimes you have to compromise, they got swept out too.
Yeah, swept. Threw the old baby out with the bathwater. You're right. I mean, you're right. The Quants were not going to take over leadership. That's reality there. But a lot of, decent old school Republicans may have, obviously did get tossed out as well. Now, we talk about, and I thought you brought up a very, very interesting point about, McDonald's isn't going to attack Burger King because they all want to sell hamburgers. Packaging. Is it, I hear a lot of talking heads on the TV saying that what the Republicans need to do is improve the articulation of the message that there's nothing wrong with the position. It's just we didn't communicate it well enough. Is what's necessary, Fergus, repackaging or does the actual message have to change now?
Well, I do think it's a little bit of both. I think that the voters overreacted a little bit. We had, Democrats, when they had the majority there in 2007, 2008, we were dominated by a number of new legislators, highly ideological, many of them motivated by Howard Dean and got involved in politics because of opposition to the Bush administration and the war.
Right.
And Terry Norelli did not rein them in those 2 years. And similarly, Bill O'Brien made no effort to rein in his group of people who were motivated by antipathy towards the Obama administration, anger about the stimulus and the big government health care. So I'm hopeful that Terry Norelli this time around will have learned some lessons from what happened 6 years ago when they were in the same position. And, when they've got those new legislators, they'll say, look, maybe you should be listening and learning for the first year. Don't feel that you have to introduce every bill just because you can and it will get a hearing. I think it remains to be seen whether Governor-elect Hassan is going to govern as a centrist or govern from the center, or if she is going to be I think she's no John Lynch in terms of her personal ideology. I think she definitely comes from the activist liberal wing of the Democratic Party. John Lynch did not.
For sure.
But is she going to say, in order to be politically successful, we have to govern from the center? I think that remains to be seen, but I think she campaigned that way. She did so even in the primary when she was competing against the candidate to her left.
Yes.
She never lurched, further than she had to. I think she'll probably be a politically shrewd governor.
I imagine so. I mean, it was politically shrewd to campaign as a centrist because, I mean, everybody could see, Democrats and Republicans, John Lynch was very, very successful, very, very popular. Yeah, he did govern from the center. A lot of Democrats thought, he's the best Republican governor we've ever had, but it wasn't really a Democrat per se. And we'll see, what she does. She's going to have a heck of a time now with the budget. Getting elected, frankly, as difficult as it is, that's the easy part. It's governing. I mean, now she said, as we all know, veto any sales or income tax. We have some significant budget problems. I wonder, Fergus Cullen, do you see any Republican proposals aside from cutting the budget? Are there, we somehow got to raise more revenue in the state of New Hampshire, and I do want to talk about national issues as well. But in terms of what we can do for this budget, it's going to be really, really tough for Maggie Hassan to govern and to deal with the budget shortfalls.
Well, look, she did acknowledge that she was open to tax increases. She mentioned tolls, she mentioned cigarettes during the course of the campaign. And, I think this is one of the issues that Republicans were obviously trying to make. Look, if you're letting the camel's nose under the tent, Katie bar the door, to mix a couple of metaphors, who knows what kind of tax increases she'll go for. But, there is a very slender Republican majority in the state Senate. I don't know if you ever served, I think you did, in a 13-11 and a 12-12 Senate.
Yeah, yes.
And as you can probably attest better than I can, when it's 13-11, no one's got a majority.
Right.
Because every member of the Senate knows they're a swing vote potentially at every issue.
True.
And that changes the dynamic. But it does mean that we aren't going to have one-party control in Concord. And that, of course, gives to moderation and compromise.
And that's one of the things, moderation and compromise. The class of 2010, the free staters, the hard right people, they were not going to compromise. They were feeling their oats. They came in there charging ahead and just, ready to go for it. And I think, as you say, my guess would be Republicans as well as Democrats would say to new people, your first year, figure out, how to get to the cafeteria, where the committee rooms are and go along and listen to it. But I don't know if that's going to happen. And again, hopefully we agree on, I think, on more things than we disagree. And that's, we want to keep the state of New Hampshire strong. We want to keep it attractive. We've already started losing businesses and losing population. Now, it's true the population has grown just because people are having kids. But older people are starting to get out. There's some sort of New Hampshire advantage. And one would hope, Fergus, that Democrats and Republicans can work together to make that happen, to bring businesses in here. And Maggie Hassan, governor-elect, has said that she wants to listen to ideas and work with the business community to keep us strong here. It'll be, it's going to be very, very interesting. I do want to move on to the national scene. It's so much fun to do that as well. I mean, what the heck? Politics, for a lot of us, it's like sports. We root for our team, and it's really a lot of fun. Mitch McConnell is the Senate Minority Leader in Washington. And right after the election, Mitch McConnell basically said to the president, yeah, we're willing to compromise as long as you do it our way. My sense is that they, they even said, Mitch McConnell said that the number one goal of the Republicans in the last 4 years was to block everything the president wanted. And I will add to this, to heck with the good of the country, but put the party first. Yeah, I suspect we disagree on that, Fergus. Do you see any willingness to compromise? It does appear that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are insisting and are digging in their heels that the Democrats must compromise, not them. I mean, it takes a lot of chutzpah to do that. But are you seeing it that way, or do you see any sense of willingness to compromise in Washington?
No, I think that we're going to continue to see gridlock. I mean, look, you ran for the United States Senate. I think that I would be very frustrated there. I think if Kelly Ayotte were put on Truth Serum, she would probably feel very frustrated that all they're trying to do is prevent the worst things from happening. And, you know, the idea that here in New Hampshire in the last 4 years, you know, last 6 years, we've had 8 elections in the congressional level. We've had 6 incumbents defeated. Only twice have incumbents been reelected to Congress. And, you know, to heck with them. I've about given up on Washington. I care very much still about states. I certainly haven't given up on the state of New Hampshire. But I don't have any high hopes for any progress that's meaningful coming out of Washington anytime soon.
Ooh, that's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear good things that were going to work better. Oh, man. Do you think Mitt Romney, we got to talk about Romney a little bit. And there's a great quote from another Republican, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, nobody accused him of being anything but, you know, a real solid Republican. But in December of 2011, he said of Romney, "This is a man without a core. This is a man without substance. This is a man that will say anything to become president of the U.S." Do you think people saw that? I mean, I saw that. It, you know, he just flipped and could say anything, anytime to anybody. It didn't even matter. Was that, did people get that he was a man without a core, or is that overstating things?
Oh, I tell you, Bert, I am a big Mitt Romney fan. I continue to be. I did not vote for him in the Republican primary. Uh-huh. I supported John Huntsman. I have no complaints or criticism about Mitt Romney. You know, I lived in Wolfboro for 6 years, and you know, if I were there again, I would look forward to running into Mitt Romney in town, as many of us did on regular occasions before. You know, he was no John Kerry in this campaign. I'm proud of the campaign they ran. I don't think it was in the cards for victory in the end. I think the Obama campaign, you know, obviously ran a very good campaign. But I'm not going to be sitting here at all criticizing the effort that Mitt Romney made.
No, it was a very certainly spirited campaign. It was a heck of a lot of money. And speaking of money, this was the first year since the infamous Citizens United decision, which really allowed a tremendous flood of money from people like the Koch brothers. And the, what's his name out there in Nevada? I can't recall his name, who put in probably...
Adelson.
Adelson, yes, yes, yes. These guys wanted to buy the election, it seems to me. And do you think, Fergus, you know, from your side of the aisle, did people react against that big money, or was it just too confusing? I mean, there was money on both sides, for sure. There were all these super PACs and just tremendous amount of talk coming at us, just, you know, flooding us every single day. Do you think the big money worked against them? Did it confuse people? I mean, the campaigns didn't control that money. They couldn't. It had to be separate and distinct. What do you think of the power of Koch's big money?
Well, I mean, first of all, I do think you're overlooking an important aspect of Citizens United, which is that it really freed up organized labor to spend whatever they wanted on the behalf of their own candidates.
Yep.
And so I think, you know, team conservative and team liberal basically spent equal resources. And I am not someone who thinks that there's too much money in politics, that there's too much speech in politics. I do think it's going to have a major impact on the, you know, I hate to jump already to 2016 because that's not really where my head is. But I saw John Thune, the senator from South Dakota, in Portsmouth and also at Newington at Pease and also in Dover on Saturday this past weekend. And, you know, John Thune had thought about running for president in the Republican primary.
And, you know,
by all accounts, one of the reasons he didn't run was skepticism about his ability to raise money. You know, look, he's a not nationally known senator from a small state
right.
in the Midwest, doesn't have the ability to raise significant dollars the way, you know, a U.S. senator from California or Texas or New York might. Well, the super PACs, I think, changed the equation entirely. You know, what did Newt Gingrich do in his presidential campaign with cable appearances and some wealthy friends supporting a super PAC on his behalf? Rick Santorum basically propped up after he finally had some early success in Iowa by super PAC funding.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the political consultants next time on for Democrats and Republicans are having those conversations over the next couple of months that say, here's what we can do for $5 million. You know? And if you've got the right rich friends, then they can keep you in the game if you show any promise. And I think that's going to have the biggest long-term impact on presidential politics.
Except, I mean, I've seen some stuff on Facebook. There was a picture of the White House, and the caption was something along the lines of, here's one house Mitt Romney couldn't buy. And, you know, the power of money, you know, why should it all be about money? Shouldn't it be? I mean, we can talk about ideals, and that's not where you or I are, Fergus. You know, it's about being practical. It's about winning. It's about moving our agendas forward and competing in a civil manner to get those in gear. But the power of money, it seems to me that, you know, you can talk about controlling supply side all you want, but wherever there's a demand, which is huge. I mean, Channel 9 made out tremendously. They have palatial digs over there. They probably made so much money they can't even imagine what to do with it. What about demand side control? I don't see people in Washington talking about requiring each radio and or especially TV stations to put aside a certain period of time. There are lots of democracies around the world where TV stations are required to provide each party, each candidate, a certain amount of time, no more, no less. They can do whatever they want. That would cut the demand tremendously and perhaps level the playing field. Having huge amounts of money, I don't know, did it upset the levelness of the playing field altogether, or in the final analysis, maybe it didn't? What do you think, Fergus?
Well, I mean, I just don't accept the premise that all money in politics is inherently corrupt or evil. You know?
Oh, nor do I.
I mean, Procter & Gamble, you know, who makes all sorts of soaps and shampoos and that kind of thing. A couple of years ago, I saw an article that they were celebrating their 17th billion-dollar brand. And if I recall, it was Febreze Air Freshener, that in America, we sell more than $1 billion worth of Febreze air freshener, and that's only one product in the air freshener market. And yet, you know, we saw Team Obama, Team Republican spend around $1 billion each in this campaign. It's not a lot of money. I just don't believe that voters are ill-served when there's more information about candidates out there on either side. It's not something that I worry about.
You know, you have a good point there. I think a lot of people did worry about that throughout the campaign, the power of money. But in the long run, you're right. They both spent roughly $1 billion. The PAC spent about the same. And there was a huge amount of money spent, you know, as I said, by the Koch brothers and others. But it didn't work. It didn't work. The people, maybe the people are smarter than that. We're talking, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, The Bert Cohen Show. Fergus Cullen, former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, maybe future chair. I don't know. I don't think Jack Kimball's going to be coming back to it. I have to tell you, I don't know if you happen to be in Portsmouth at all recently, Fergus, but Jack Kimball has a place near the Portsmouth Traffic Circle, and on his marquee-type sign a few days ago, it said, "Obama is running guns to Al-Qaeda." I couldn't make this stuff up. Is his wing of the party, Jack Kimball, is he was briefly chair of the Republican Party in the state of New Hampshire. Do you think that the party is going to perhaps, I can say it, maybe you can't, smarten up and go more toward, you know, reasonableness and not, frankly, wackos like that?
You know, Bert, the best thing about not being state party chairman is that I don't have to deal with the crazies. You can quote me on that. I don't care.
Right.
I've got a lot of trouble with the crazies, and the crazies had far too much rope in the last couple of years, and now most of them have lost. And you know, my sense, and I've only been involved in politics for, you know, 20 years, but my sense is that a lot of the new activists who surfaced in response to President Obama in 2009 and beyond, many of them would be self-described Tea Partiers. My expectation is that 3-4 years from now, most of them will not be involved in politics anymore, that they will be like the Ross Perot supporters of the early 90s, that they got engaged, they participated, and then they went back into the woodwork. And you know, I think that that this movement has badly damaged the Republican brand in New Hampshire in the last couple of years because they were irresponsible when given power. And I think that Ovid Lamontagne just paid a price for that extremism and that being off message. You know, so I don't want to hear of any more birthers being tolerated in my party. I don't want to hear about any more conspiracy theories around Agenda 21, how the UN is secretly trying to manipulate, you know, environmental policy by taking over planning boards in New Hampshire cities. You know, this kind of crazy talk, I've got no tolerance for it.
Yeah, the average person, the average independent, it just doesn't connect with them. You know it, and I know it. But what do you think is going to happen with the Republican Party in New Hampshire now? I can ask two ways, you know, and as someone said, untitled is untethered. You know, you can do what you want. What would you like to see happen to the Republican Party, and what do you think realistically will happen?
Well, I mean, you know, it's going to be a tough time. I'm more worried about the party at the national level because I think that we need to modernize. And by that, I mean, you don't compromise your conservative principles, but you adapt them to modern times and modern issues. You know, for example, the party has to get on the right side of immigration reform. Mm. It's a demographic tipping. First of all, it's good policy. It's the right thing to do. But it's also a demographic time bomb that is ticking against Republicans in states like New Mexico and Colorado and California and even Texas. And
certainly,
you know,
Florida
may not
too,
be as much of a visible issue in New Hampshire, but we got to fix that. We can't be losing the women's vote by 22 points in governor's elections. The Republican strategy to win cannot be based on getting 120% of the white male vote. That ain't going to work.
Yeah.
The math, I've done the math. I've run the numbers. There aren't enough of them. So there's that. But, you know, within New Hampshire, you know, when the Democrats took over in 2007, it was a shock to the system, I think, even for a lot of New Hampshire Democrats.
Oh, yes.
Never expected to be in the majority.
For sure.
This time it's not quite the same shock. It looks like Gene Chandler is likely to become the House Republican leader in Concord. If so, that would be a very good thing for the party. Here's a guy who's been involved for 25 years. He's very much an establishment Republican. He's been there in good years. He's been there in bad years. He's got perspective. He's not a hothead.
Right.
That will be good.
Yeah.
I think the state Senate, with a reduced majority now for Republicans, you know, with leaders like Peter Bragdon, Jeb Bradley,
mm-hmm.
again, these guys are not bomb throwers. They're not hotheads. Nancy Stiles in the Seacoast,
right.
not a bomb thrower, not a hothead. You know, I don't think that the Republicans will not be doing damage to themselves over the next 2 years the way they did in the last two.
Yeah, it does seem to be the case, and I will agree with you. Gene Bartlett, just a decent guy. You can't possibly question his conservative credentials. He's absolutely a conservative. You can't, I don't know if he's moderate on anything, but he's certainly not a bomb thrower. He's not an extremist, but I mean, Gene Chandler, I said it wrong. You know, he could be strong. And it's interesting that you said that you voted for John Huntsman, and you talk about the Seacoast State Senator Nancy Stiles. That's my sense is, and I was urging Republicans years ago to kind of go that direction, that's the way New Hampshire's going. That's the way the country is going. You know, here we are well into the 21st century. And as you said, I mean, just looking at the demographics, it's not, America is not the same. It's not the same to have, you know, openly white male domination. It's just not going to cut it anymore. And to resist that, I think there's a tremendous amount of resistance to it. And frankly, it was seen as a lot of racism. It was seen that way, whether or not it's true. I would think the Republican Party has to adapt and, recognize that there are a lot more Hispanic Americans. That's just happening. It is happening. It's not a bad thing. To resist it is, you know, it seems to me it's not only the wrong thing to do, but politically it's just not wise. Do you sense that the Republican Party is getting that as of Tuesday?
Well, I think, certainly the strategist level, they all recognize this.
Yeah.
You know, the Karl Roves of the party, the Jeb Bushes of the party, you know, even people on the local level like me, there is consensus on this issue. And it'll be put to a real test again in the presidential primary process, which we're going to get to enjoy a front row seat again for both Democrats and Republicans.
That's for sure. You're right about
4 years.
Yeah.
You know, look, John Huntsman tested this 2 years ago, you know, with his presidential campaign. He found, you know, he finished a credible third in New Hampshire with like 17% of the vote.
Yeah, it was impressive.
But he basically found that there was not a market for him. I suspect there will be a bigger market for that message in the next cycle, but we'll see. You know, or are they going to, you know, but there will be other Republicans out there, and you know it as well as I, who will be saying, if only Republicans had nominated Michelle Bachmann and really given the country a choice in this election. You know, they'll be, Ron Paul got 24% of the Republican presidential primary vote in New Hampshire back in January. That's a huge number. And, you know, the Republican Party is going to have a reckoning with that because, you know, that's not, it's no longer something that can be ignored. And, you know, so it could get ugly before it gets better. And I'm not sure which direction the party's going to go.
Well, I wonder if there's some ability, we won't find out, time will tell, and history is always unexpected. But as you mentioned, the Ron Paul segment, that, you know, that's not something that, like the Tea Party people that you think, and I tend to agree, you know, might just be like the Perot people, just kind of go away. The Ron Paul people, that's a cause. They talk about it as a cause. They have been there for a while. They're really different from Democrats and from most Republicans, largely libertarian. They wanted to, you know, stop the imperialism and the militarism that we've had in this country and work on American issues and deal with the our monetary system. I wonder if it's possible that the John Huntsmans, the Nancy Stiles, the moderates, the more traditional moderates of the Republican Party can in any way incorporate that, because there's a lot of people there, you know, and the fact that the main delegation, the people who were legitimately elected to the Republican convention, were Ron Paul delegates, and they were shut out of that convention. People are not going to forget that. What do you think about the Ron Paul voter factor?
Well, I mean, I counsel every Republican to treat a Ron Paul supporter as a swing voter in a general election, to not treat them like they are Republicans, because largely they're not. And even in the first congressional district, where to my shock and dismay, Carol Shea Porter has been returned to Congress. I mean, I just think she's an awful candidate and is way out of the mainstream. But she won. And there are some Republicans saying, look, the Libertarian took 4% in that vote.
Amazing.
If that person hadn't been in there, Frank Inta would have been reelected.
Well, that's not
true.
Well,
you know, that's assuming that 4% came out of the Republicans' hide.
Good point.
I don't assume that at all.
No, it's true. The libertarians are real, and they're alienated from a lot of the currently mainstream Republicans. I mean, of course, it's nice to disagree with you on something. I'm thrilled that Carol Shea Porter is back in there. I think she's a better policymaker than candidate, quite frankly. But I tend to agree with her on most everything. I think I think it's a good thing. And the 4% that went for the Libertarian, you're right. Who knows where that would have gone? One thing I found really interesting, Fergus, is the swing vote. There were an amazingly large number of people who hadn't decided until the last minute. From everything I've heard, the last minute deciders actually broke Democrat. Tell me if you agree with this. The last minute deciders were thinking, yeah, I like the Republicans, but they've gone way too far. I just can't relate to that. And just broke Democrat. It's a fascinating thing that there are so many last minute deciders, because there were such big differences between the two, Obama and Romney. But what do you think of the fact that they, in general, the last minute deciders did in fact break Democrat?
Yeah, I agree that in the last week things moved in the Democratic direction. And even in the last weekend, in a way that I had not fully expected. Look, we'll never know, you know, what was the political impact of Hurricane Sandy, but you know, I do think that it basically was a political opportunity for the president to look, you know, like a president and to do things that only a president can do. and that President Obama did those things. I don't suggest one bit that it was politically motivated, but I am suggesting that we can't ignore the fact that it was a political opportunity and that he took it. And, you know, I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying it's a fact. But, you know, so maybe that was a factor in how that kind of broke. It wasn't like the Romney campaign made any mistakes going down the stretch. But, you know, sometimes you just get beat. And, you know, I think that's what happened. But at the local level, again, at the state level, I think that, you know, Republicans have to acknowledge in New Hampshire that something different happened here than happened in the rest of the country, where it was basically a status quo election and Mitt Romney, alas, simply fell short. It was a wave, a rogue wave that just hit our state and, you know, swept out 126 members of the Republican caucus in the legislature, both congressional seats, control of the executive council, and a governor's race that everyone thought was probably going to be a low single-digit fare one way or the other. That's Maggie huge. Hassan wins by 12.
12
this
points.
Is not good. This is a problem.
I'm rather pleased. What can I say? As a partisan Democrat, I'm pleased. I also think as a person who cares deeply, as do you, about the future of New Hampshire, I think it's a good thing. It's going to be a heck of a difficult time. We have some really serious problems, and there has to be less acrimony. People, you know, independents, everybody was sick of the acrimony, and, you know, and they call it bitter partisanship. I don't know if that's the right word, but there was acrimony and difficulty. When I was in the state Senate, it was far more civil, I thought. We made a sign that said, stop the craziness, restore respect and common sense. This year, vote Democratic. I think people did. They didn't like the acrimony. Do you think the people who were elected get that people are sick of the acrimony and are willing to actually compromise, that compromise won't be a dirty word now?
Well, I mean, to some extent, you know, I spoke with State Senator Jeb Bradley and Peter Bragdon on election night, and I heard Senator Bradley on the radio somewhere else. I do think that there was a big difference this past cycle between the New Hampshire State Senate and the New Hampshire State House.
For sure.
The New Hampshire State Senate was just as conservative as the New Hampshire State House, but they managed to keep out of all the controversies, the focus on their business. I don't think it necessarily saved them on Election Day. I'm not sure that's why they retained a majority and the House lost it. But all of the craziness was really concentrated in the House. And that's part of why I'm laying the finger of blame on the Speaker, Bill O'Brien, because it wasn't like this was, you know, the Republicans nominated for governor somebody like Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch, the two Senate candidates who lost. Yeah. In Missouri and Indiana. It wasn't like we nominated Christine O'Donnell. You know, we nominated a good, quality, capable candidate in person who was ready to lead in Ovid Lamontagne, who ran basically a decent campaign. Perfect, no. Decent campaign, yes. So all of the craziness was really concentrated in one segment of the ticket. That was the House Republican caucus, and it did damage to everybody else.
Again, Bill O'Brien was the best Democratic organizer we could have asked for. I got to ask, the Ovid LaMontagne campaign had those TV ads on Maggie Hassan's house. Now, number one, to start with, to show somebody's house on TV really crosses the line, I think. And then to say that, well, she doesn't pay her taxes. Well, I think once that ad came out, I'd be curious to see what you think, that almost guaranteed a Maggie win. On its own, because people knew, no, she doesn't own her house. She is required to live on campus housing. Her husband is principal at Phillips Exeter Academy. They don't pay for their house. They don't own the house. I think that absolutely, from that point on, Maggie was going to win. It was only a question of by what percentage. Your take, Fergus Cullen?
Well, number one, that ad was not by Ovid. It was by supporters of Ovid. It was by the Republican Governors Association. I know, perhaps in your eyes and that of many listeners, that's a difference without a distinction, or rather the other way around, a distinction without a difference. But nonetheless, you can't fully hold Ovid responsible for that message.
Number for sure, two, that's true.
I think it was a legitimate topic. You could tell the way the Democrats reacted to it that they were bothered. And number three, Let's acknowledge that Jackie Silly had basically had a whispering campaign in her primary against Maggie Hassan on exactly the same issue. So it was legitimate in the views of a lot of Democrats then, and it was legitimate now. Look, your governor, she was a state senator. She was voting on things that affected her constituents but did not affect her. That's a legitimate issue.
Well, the I can tell you from being a you know somebody who was with Jackie Silly, they were only concerned that the Republicans were going to use that as an issue. They you know they weren't, but that's be that as it may. Interesting. I mean, I can see how. Well, yeah, there is a difference between the RGA and the Ovid campaign. No question about that. It is a legitimate difference. Now, at the end, Ovid's comments were really really bitter. He said that they were you know that he was just attacked. He didn't acknowledge any degree of responsibility at all. I'm not sure how often he has run and lost now. I'm not sure if it's three or four times. He ran for governor against Gene Shaheen in 96. He ran for U.S. Senate. Did pretty well against Kelly Ayotte. Seemed pretty promising. What do you think now? Is it over for Ovid and has, you know, his... At the end of a campaign, generally, it's a good idea to think of it as a start of your next campaign. He didn't do that very well. What do you think about Ovid's
future? No, listen, and you're also, he ran for Congress in 1992 at a primary as well, and that was
his
first race where he started making a name for himself politically. So look, Ovid has run four times. He has not. He's won the nomination twice. He's been defeated in generals twice. Great guy, no more political future for Ovid.
Right.
Of great future in terms of contributing to the state, I hope. I consider him a personal friend and mentor and someone that I will certainly look to for guidance on all sorts of things for the rest of my life, I hope. But, you know, politically he's done. I was in, you know, with him on election night. I was in the hall for his concession speech. I will acknowledge it was not the most graceful speech that I've ever heard, especially from Ovid. But you know what? I'm going to give him a pass. It was a hard-fought campaign. He was very disappointed.
Yes.
And that's understandable. Look, and he was subject to some really aggressive ads as well, and that's tough on a family.
Yeah.
Look, the Democrats put up signs around the state saying he was, you know, in favor of ending public education and ending kindergarten, and you know, you get a thick skin in politics, but I expect him to be human as well.
And the family isn't required to develop a thick skin. I can tell you that, because it is tough. It can be tough. And I know Ovid personally. He worked for us in the state Senate when I was there, and very, very decent guy, a nice guy, a really, really decent person. Charlie Bass, is he finished? And what about Ginta?
Well, you know, I was in the hall also for the two WMUR debates a week ago on Friday night, and I have grown to like Charlie Bass a lot. In fact, I like Charlie Bass 2.0 a lot better, frankly, than I liked Charlie Bass 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, as I watched that debate in the hall last Friday, I got the impression that, you know, Charlie would like to be reelected to Congress, but if it doesn't work out, it wasn't going to be the end of his life. It wasn't going to be the end of his world. You know, he had the good judgment to not seek an immediate rematch against Paul Hodes in 2008. I think the 4 years that he stayed out of Congress did him a lot of good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether he has the chance to run again or not, I don't know. I suspect he's probably going to hang him up, but he's a person who, again, he's been out of office before. I think it did him good to be able to focus on other things. He'll probably be able to do that again. Frank Ginta, more interesting political thing because he's younger. You know, he's, of course, the former mayor of Manchester. There was, you know, some speculation that he's thinking about running for U.S. Senate against Gene Shaheen. It'll be interesting to see. You know, look, Maggie Hassan was defeated for state Senate 2 years ago.
Right.
2 years later, she's elected governor.
Right.
You know, there aren't. Carol Shea Porter came back after a tough defeat and gets reelected to Congress. So it's going to be hard to make the case to any Republican who lost that this is a permanent defeat and the end of a career. They're all going to credibly be able to say, you know, I can come back from this. Others have done so and done so very recently.
That's true. That's true. And I knew Charlie when he was in the state Senate, when he was Charlie pre-1.0, and he was fairly moderate. A nice guy. I still consider him a friend. Ginta, you know, he's still got that investigation hanging over him. I'm a little surprised they haven't finished that yet. But I think Charlie can adjust. You know, he knows that there is life after being in Congress. But Ginta, I wouldn't put a lot of money on his revival. I don't see that happening. I got to ask one thing that I should have asked earlier. Benghazi. I had a feeling the Republican Party kept hammering it and hammering. Maybe I shouldn't say the Republican Party, actually. Fox News and the Tea Party types kept hammering Benghazi. And I still believe that helped tip the balance in favor of the president, because it was so out to lunch. It was such insanity, really, to suggest that the president allowed this terrorist attack to happen, and somehow blaming the president for this terrorist attack. It's like Kimball Sines saying Obama was running guns to Al-Qaeda. It's absurd. I think that really, really discredited Romney and the Republican. Now, Romney, I didn't hear him personally say stuff about the attacks in Benghazi, but I don't know. I just thought that stretched things so far that it couldn't help but make the middle think, wait, this is ridiculous here. This is such, shallow, frankly, shameful politicizing of a terrorist tragedy. Did you think that was a legitimate line of politicking?
Well, I guess I've got a somewhat different take on it. I mean, I certainly don't believe that the president or his administration allowed this attack to happen. I think it was a terrible tragedy and a failing. And I think the Obama administration made a terrible mistake of having an evolving story on it. You know, they were trying to blame this on some YouTube video when it was a coordinated terrorist attack, and they were very slow to acknowledge that. And in fact, they had tried to, I think, mislead people about the nature of the attack.
They were still getting information.
Well, but I don't. First of all, I don't think voters really care a whole lot about foreign policy. I think that's one of the reasons why it wasn't a dispositive attack. But look, I've watched foreign policy to this extent and seen that candidate Obama 4 or 5 years ago thought basically that everything the Bush administration did was wrong. He gets in office and realizes, these aren't black and white. There's a lot of gray. I know I said I would close down Guantanamo Bay, but we got some real bad guys there, and it's hard to know what to do with them. And I know I said I'd get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan, but you know what? It's a difficult situation. We need to have a military presence over there, and we're basically going to continue and extend the Bush administration's policies. So I think it's very hard to get clear-cut wins politically, domestically, on foreign policy issues.
And it does seem that from every analysis that I've seen, that when people looked at foreign policy, they gave it to the president, because they just thought, he's running a very, very middle of the road, perhaps even right of center foreign policy that's happening now. And, Democrats, I think, to his left, of which there are a lot, I think we'll probably keep up the pressure on that. I got to tell you, when I was standing in line to vote on Tuesday, the guy behind me said he was voting against Obama because he was a communist. And it just amazes me how that line of, I can't even call it thinking. I mean, it's just absurd. And, let's face it, a lot of the Democrats thought that, would they label Bill Clinton a communist? He was no more centrist than Barack Obama. Barack Obama may be, part of a hair to the left of center, but he's pretty centrist. I can't help but think that, let's face it, this country is not as white as it used to be. And that the age of rich white men always getting their way is over. There was some degree of, there was some undertone that, you could call Obama a communist, largely because, look, he's the other. He looks different. There's part of that. I'm guessing you're bristling at this line of thought here, but the country's changing. It's less white men rule than it used to be.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the fact. And, that's partly why I say the Republican Party needs to modernize on immigration reform and get on the right side of this issue. Again, first of all, I feel that way absolutely on a policy and moral standpoint. But I also think politically as well, that's true. So, one of these days I mean to put together a column about all the declining opportunities for white men in my generation. But I say that because I just think there's, we're tapping so much more potential out there with, of course, not only women having equal opportunities, but also new immigrant populations, minority groups, and all this, I think, of course, is a very positive thing for the country.
Absolutely, and they're just as patriotic and dedicated to America as anybody else, maybe even more so. I always find that it's fascinating to me that, new citizens know so much more about who we are, about our Constitution. You know, they have a real investment here. So there's possibilities, I would think, Fergus, for young people and women to get more involved in your party. You must be a little bit concerned, but not entirely unoptimistic, if I can make up that word.
I'm a little tired, I gotta say, you know, because I've been battling in the, you know, in the trenches on this for a number of years, and I don't expect that I'm going to lay down my arms and get out of the fight, but,
right.
I certainly tried to be a leader within my party to nudge it in what I see as the right direction. Everyone likes to see themselves as a voice of reason, and I certainly, you know, like to see myself that way, too.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I am, maybe I'm not. But, there's been some very ugly times within the Republican Party in the last 4 to 6 years, and it's unclear to me whether it's going to get uglier now after a tough defeat like this, if Republicans are going to say, you know what, whatever we've been doing hasn't been working and we need to make some adjustments. So I'm hopeful that the party will move in a positive, constructive direction, but I'm not sure that it will.
Interesting. Well, if people want to follow you and your work, what website would you suggest they go to?
Well, you know, probably the New Hampshire Union Leader. I'll have a column on the editorial page tomorrow with more of my take on what just happened and what the party needs to do to change things in the future. So that's probably the best place.
And that's tomorrow being November 9th for people who may listen to this afterwards. It'll be in there November 9th. Fergus Cullen, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cullen Show.
Thank you for having me, Senator. Appreciate it.
All right. And we'll see what happens now as the Republicans start crawling from the wreckage. Here's Rockpile to sing that very song.
Into a brand new car.